Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello everyone, and welcome to New Books in Art. My name is Ricarda, and I'm one of the hosts of the channel. Today, I'm here to talk to Elizabeth Fraser about her latest book, Mediterranean Encounters, Artists Between Europe and the Ottoman Empire, between 1774 and 1839, published in 2017 by Pennsylvania State University Press. Welcome to the show, Elizabeth.
Thank you, Ricarda.
Why don't you start out by telling us a bit about yourself and how you came to the field of art history?
Well, when I was a student, art history was going through a lot of changes. It was a very exciting field at that time, and I think that's what attracted me. It was going through a lot of sort of self-reflection. It was the period when I think art history began importing sort of methodologies from other fields and really looking to literary criticism or anthropology and sort of social history. And it was a sort of watershed moment of change in the discipline. And it was terribly exciting. Everyone was sort of challenging each other. There was a lot of debate. And I think that's really what galvanized me as a young student. I really wanted to be part of that. And I was drawn particularly, I think, to 19th century France, because at that moment, that was the field in which a lot of that interrogation was concentrated. A lot of really interesting and a kind of whole varieties of approaches were all being kind of tested out in 19th century French art. And I think in some ways, it has to do with my current interests in sort of Mediterranean studies and cross-cultural encounters too, because of this, this also, I think, challenges fundamentally the way we do art history or, you know, do probably history itself. And I think probably that's for me the link.
This ties in nicely with my second question about the title of your book, Mediterranean Encounters. And in your words, the concept of the Mediterranean as a shared world has received much less attention in art history than in other fields. Could you elaborate on this and how you chose the body of work you discuss in this book?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the concept of the Mediterranean and Mediterranean studies, these are definitely beginning to make big inroads in certain periods in art history, ancient art in particular, medieval, I think also pretty heavily, and perhaps a little bit in the Renaissance, but certainly not in the kind of later early modern period or the modern period, which has been really dominated by this kind of Orientalist discussion, which presumes disconnection rather than, you know, sort of long sustained interactions, which is what Mediterranean studies is about. So I wouldn't, you know, I would probably want to qualify that and say that, you know, certainly some art historians are paying attention to it. I think that one of the things that's really valuable about this whole Mediterranean studies approach is, you know, being sort of ocean-based, this idea of kind of culture around an ocean really gets us beyond these standard sort of geopolitical boundaries that we have tended to use to divide up the field, very nation-based, in particular French art, English art, etc. So that has been very helpful to me in sort of reformulating this period that I'm looking at, 18th and 19th century, really, which again has been dominated by a kind of Orientalist discussion and sort of theory. I came to it through my discoveries of Delacroix's Moroccan notebooks. I came to the book, I should say. I saw them in an exhibition. I saw several of them in an exhibition, and just was really taken by how different they looked from his other paintings. My first book was on Delacroix in France. And I was trying to understand why he made images that were so fundamentally different from the kinds of both themes, but also handling of his, his approach to painting. And I started thinking about travel images as a genre. I thought, well, maybe that would be a way of kind of understanding what made them specific. And so I just began looking at a lot of travel imagery from that period, sort of, 18th century, early 19th century, extending back into the 17th century, just to sort of get some kind of grounding and sort of understand what he came from, what kind of imagery may have informed his approach to travel. And the more I looked, the more I realized that what I was looking at was Mediterranean, that all of these travel books, these really very incredible objects, took the Mediterranean as their focus. And slowly but surely, I began to understand the more deeply I got into the field, I began to understand that, in fact, the Mediterranean was a very Ottoman sea at that point in time, and that I needed to understand the Ottoman Empire. So that's how I finally got to my focus on the Ottomans. In terms of sort of chapters and deciding what to focus on and which books, it kind of resulted fairly naturally from looking closely at these travel books. It became very clear that that there was a particularly important early book by Choiseul Gouffier, The Voyage Pittoresque de la Grèce, The Picturesque Voyage into Greece, that was sort of the foundational travel book for most of my travelers, a very influential, very important volume, very beautiful. Actually, it's three volumes all told. And so I sort of gradually charted my way through various kinds of responses to that work, roughly moving chronologically. And some of those responses were Ottoman responses. One of my books is an Ottoman sponsored piece that is was produced by actually an Ottoman interpreter, born in the Ottoman Empire, originally Ottoman subject, who made a travel book in France, all the way up to then Delacroix himself, who was very clearly aware of Choiseul Gouffier's book, and also in some sense responded to it. So that became the sort of guiding thread throughout the book, sort of this first travel book and how the others sort of reworked and responded to it.
Let me follow up on the idea of the Mediterranean. I'm just wondering, how do these travel books that take the Mediterranean as their starting point differ, if at all, from other travel books of the famous Grand Tour that mostly aristocrats at the time were taking throughout, not just the Mediterranean, but also other parts of what we now call Europe?
Yeah, I mean, part of it has to do with the time period, I would say, but they overlap, but also geographies, obviously sort of what we associate with the Grand Tour has a very strong kind of focus on Italy. It's and sort of it expands slowly eastward to Greece, which was a part of the Ottoman Empire at this point, and into Anatolia. Those are sort of later additions to what one considers the Grand Tour. I think there's no sort of absolute difference or contrast. They're obviously related activities. They come to various themes. They share antiquarianism is a big focus of a lot of the travel material that I look at. So, I don't think there's really an absolute contrast. A lot of the figures are aristocrats, for instance. But it depends on each case. And I think that's the most important thing to say, is that each book has a slightly different focus because of who is in charge and the particular stakes in making a book and the historical context, I would say, for each book really, really makes a difference.
Great. You show this quite nicely in the discussion of each and every travel book and even image that you talk about as well. But we'll start out with Comte Choiseul Gouffier, whom you've mentioned already, and his Voyage pittoresque de la Grèce, which he published shortly after returning to Paris, as I understand, from a long stay in the Ottoman Empire as its ambassador as well. And you show how influential he was in his position as ambassador and how instrumental he was in forging diplomatic exchanges between the Ottoman and the French court. But you also argue that his Voyage pittoresque was probably even more influential and instrumental. Indeed. And I was wondering if you could talk about this one particular book with a bit more detail and introduce it to our listeners, so to speak.
Okay, yes, definitely. Well, it was a vast undertaking to make a book like this, assumed an extraordinary amount of capital and various other kinds of resources that only a very powerful person would have access, and other things. The work of many engravers, the work of many researchers. He produced three volumes in total. The first volume appeared in 1782, and that is the one that most people end up talking about, because I think it's really sort of the most cohesive piece. And when sort of the funding was most rich, and the other two volumes were sort of pulled together much later in time. They are heavily illustrated volumes. They have illustrations, beautiful copper engravings, almost every other page. There is text by Choiseul Gouffier, which responds to previous travelers in the areas where he went. He spent quite a bit of time, in Greece, but he also enters other areas of the Ottoman Empire. He moves eastward from there. It became so important that it's cited by everyone afterwards, of course, cited by my other authors, and it was really a collector's object. And it's, I think, hard for us to understand how that might work, but that it became so prestigious that he was nominated into various academies and, as you said, eventually was appointed as ambassador because of this great work that he made. He does clearly sort of move against the grain of the Ottoman Empire. He doesn't refer that much to Ottomans. He prefers a kind of classical or antique template or filter through which to see the world that he depicts. Asia Minor instead of Anatolia, for instance. those are very important aspects of the book itself. He doesn't tend to talk much about contemporary life, although notably he, unlike a lot of other travelers, he also doesn't excise, for instance, when he's traveling through Greece, he does not try to omit in his views of what is depicted, mosques, for instance, which clearly indicate that Greece is now an Ottoman country. But otherwise, he's very biased towards the kind of classical tradition. The book is also Philhellenic, very strongly so, taking part in that sort of European-based revival of the notion of ancient Greece and the idea that that contemporary Greeks are somehow debased, that they have been kind of reduced in stature, even sort of that their culture has been sort of polluted by contact with long contact with the Ottomans, and that to return to the classical past will, you know, sort of rejuvenate contemporary Greece. That's very much a position that he shares ultimately with a lot of Western European culture. It's not actually something that was of great concern to Greeks at that point in time themselves.
And it's in this chapter as well that you compare his work to that of Forbin's. And in order to talk the reader through different modes of viewing and consuming these illustrated travel books, I find it particularly interesting how you posit that there's no unified approach to the representation of travel encounters in the Near East, and that instead each book, and indeed especially in the case of Forbin, each image, deserves to be looked at as an independent work of art. And you've mentioned this already in this podcast. To an extent, you seem to juxtapose Troezen's and Forbin's images, the former depicting Ottoman Greece in an ordered and domesticated way, whereas the latter allows for spontaneity in his lithographs. To my mind, and I'm happy to discuss this with you, Forbin seems to be kind of more dedicated to the idea of the picturesque and potentially, arguably, the sublime as well, as introduced in the late 18th century. And I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Yeah, of course, that's interesting. Yes, they are very different books, and that was, of course, part of the point, is to really really pay attention to the way in which each travel book has its own particularities, and therefore it kind of inflects any overarching messages that we may try to attribute to a corpus of books like this. That in each case, we really have to look a lot more closely than people had done at text and image relationships, the relationship among images and such. I think that's really important. And of course, one of the major differences is that Choiseul Gouffier made his book in the late-ish 18th century and is using copper engravings. And Forbin's book was made, in the second decade of the 19th century and is lithographic. And so they look very different. And that, I think that's really important, the kind of softness of lithography and the kind of drawn qualities of lithography that I think automatically give it a kind of looser, sketchier sort of feeling that conveys that feeling of spontaneity that I was talking about, whereas the Choiseul's engravings are much more tightly conceived and, you know, very masterful printmaking skills are really exhibited in them. I think that one of the things that's really interesting about looking closely at those kinds of images, particularly in the case of Forbin, where almost all the images are done by different lithographers, so obviously there are some repetitions among the images, is that once we kind of acknowledge that and see how differently each image looks, and realize that that Forbin himself did not make those images, that we can no longer really talk about a kind of controlling, sort of unified, sort of authorial, you know, a control over the book itself. So his text does one thing. He actually does produce images. He doesn't produce the final lithographs. And once we see that variety, we kind of see how it couldn't be Forbin sort of intending one approach or another, but that whatever he wanted his project to be had to pass through this filter of all these different makers. And so he may have been committed to one aesthetic ideal or another, but of course the artists who make his lithographs, you know, might pull his work in a different kind of direction. I think that nostalgia is a really good way of thinking about Forbin. I think the fact that he's revisiting sort of, particularly when he's in Egypt, he's revisiting places that the Napoleonic army was in, and that he's, you know, looking at these spaces as a Frenchman who can feel this kind of loss of, you know, the possibility of French empire. I think that really inflects some of what we see. And the lithographs themselves, I think, kind of convey that sense of melancholy. There's a lot of sentiment both in his text and in the lithographs, I think, in particular. So that's a very strong difference from Choiseul Gouffier, who is really trying to convince his readers to some degree of the commercial viability of Greece, for instance, or, you know, what we would call Ottoman spaces, which he does not call them, the idea that there should be French investment and French trade in these areas, I think, is kind of an underlying idea. So we see a lot of port images in his book, and there's a kind of serenity, and as you said, domestication. There's something very inviting and very calm in his images, which is very different from the approach that we see in Forbin.
Again, let me follow up on this. Is it possible to reconstruct which of these two different viewpoints were more popular amongst the French people at that time? So, was it Choiseul's kind of economic investment in Ottoman territory, or Forbin's kind of lost empire, reminiscence of a lost empire or territory?
That's a really interesting, an interesting question. It's so hard to gauge these things. We have critics responding. We have a fair amount of critical response to travel books, although a lot of them tend to be synopses. I would say that probably each of them were kind of popular in their time because they really are responding to perspectives of the moment. Forbin's book coming so close after the fall of, you know, the Napoleonic Empire, the end of Napoleon's reign. And I think his book would automatically be sort of read that way to some degree. And Choiseul is looking at a very particular moment in time as well. There's a lot of concern about Russian engagement in conflict with the Ottomans, and the fact that the Russians are sort of horning in and, taking parts of the Ottoman Empire from the Ottomans. So there's a lot of anxiety in Western Europe that the Russians will gain the upper hand. And I think Choiseul Gouffier is very aware of these sort of European level politics and wanting to make sure that the French sort of get their hands in, you know, as soon as they can. So I suspect in that sense that they were both very popular in their time and speak to the moment of that time. As far as we can tell, both of them were, you know, sold well. They appeared in many editions throughout Europe in different languages. So all those things that we can do to know the history of a book itself as an object would certainly suggest their great popularity. And that would be true of any of the books in the study. They were all, very, very prominent publications that people look to and bought and sold, and books that moved around quite a bit and again were translated, etc.
Great. And yet some of these have kind of fallen into oblivion today, but we'll come on to that a little later. I want to follow up on something that you've mentioned already, and this is a very important point I think you make in this chapter, which is the question of a single authorship of these travel books. And you challenge this common narrative that gives credit only to one great master author, and fail to acknowledge the collaborative and dialogic nature of these books and the many other agents involved in these complex undertakings whom you've mentioned already: cartographers, specialized researchers, artists, engravers, printers, and so on and so forth. But then you also, and again, you've mentioned this in the podcast already, underscore the intertextuality of travel books, each book referring back to an earlier body of work, each situating itself within a complex web of other travel books. And I was hoping you could say a few more words on this point.
Yeah, for sure. Part of the reason why someone wants to read a travel book is that it claims to give something new, of course, to its audience. And so there's a lot of one-upmanship. It's a very competitive world. And authors are extremely conscious of what has been done previously, what views have been made available, if they can offer several new views or maybe a plan or an elevation where that was not given in a previous travel book. So there's an awful lot of citation with a kind of competitive eye in all this travel literature. So that's certainly part of it. And I think that authors assume that they're that their audience is to some degree aware of these other books. I mean, the books that I'm talking about are really monumental publications. They're very large books, as I said before, very expensive to produce. So they kind of make a mark in the world in a way that's perhaps different from a small, what would be called an octavo book, a much smaller object. These are really hard to handle, hard to move around, very expensive. Again, noticeable landmarks, we might say, in the history of publication. So one can, an author will know that these other previous landmarks are things that people will be concerned with and will want to understand the relationship. So that's one way in which you could understand that something that is intertextual. But there are other cases and ways in which I think the knowledge of sort of previous images or texts forms a kind of echo into the text or image of any given travel book. And I think that's sort of the more profoundly intertextual zone. So one of my examples is the very fact that the description of Egypt, really famous, massive, 21 some volumed product of the Napoleonic voyage, that was something that people would have, of course, been aware of. It wasn't entirely completed when Forbin made his book. But I think that when he depicts, this view or that view of Egypt, or when his artists do, that people were very aware of, the kinds of images you would see in the description of Egypt, and could see sort of the gap between them or the difference between them. There's something, they are engravings, the images in the description of Egypt, very, very different, very sort of austere almost, sometimes even somewhat mechanical looking, compared to the kind of soft, velvety qualities of these lithographs that in Forbin's book. And I think that his book to some degree relies on that sort of visual expectation and visual knowledge, and sort of gives his book and his images an even more kind of, as I say, nostalgic quality, because kind of feeling the difference between those, so those image types. And so for me, again, that is a, that kind of echo underneath, a visual echo underneath any given travel book, I think is a, is the more profoundly intertextual aspect of these travel books. Yeah.
Maybe you could say a few more words on how these books were viewed, because you talk about, you know, their enormous size, and how they're today difficult to handle. And yet at the time, it must have been an incredible spectacle to turn the pages and kind of, you know, not just read through the book, but also kind of wander around the landscape, as you would do, for example, in comparison to comparing it to Chinese hand scrolls, you know, which you roll in sequences, and it's an embodied viewing, really, an embodied viewing experience. I think this is the same for these travel books.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, that for me was just such a fascinating aspect of doing the research for this book, because I had worked really on, you know, major 19th century easel paintings before. So you're dealing with one singular object with clearly one, you know, one artist, you know, kind of controlling the process. I think that the fact that they are, you know, these large images, the fact that, you know, that there are so many images put together that you have to experience them as a sequence because they're bound images, is very important to the effect they have. It's also one of the reasons why it's very hard to convey this in reproduction or in publication, because I think the size of these images, I mean, some of the prints and some of the travel books I looked at are several feet by several feet. So when we reproduce them, you know, in a couple inches in a book, of course, we've lost some of that kind of feeling of sort of almost being in the land, kind of as you were implying. I think the sequence is really interesting because these are travel books. So the sense that is often used in them of sort of the journey through a space, as you move sequentially through the book, you usually sort of progress through a geographic space. Some books play with that, I think, more than others. Some books feel like just a kind of collection of separate images, but others really use that function of moving through time and space in the sequence of the pages themselves, which is really fascinating.
Great. Now let's go on to chapter 2, In the Shadow of Les Grands. And here you go on to discuss the fate of one individual associated with Choiseul, the French artist Louis-François Cassin. His ambitious travel book, which in your words can be seen as a kind of Eastern Mediterranean panorama covering several regions within the Ottoman Empire, is a monument in its own right. Cassin expands the monumental not just into his landscapes, but also into the human realm as well. And I would like you to talk a bit more about this monumentality of Cassin's work and indeed his ambitions, which are in contrast really to the ill fate of his project.
Yeah, he's extraordinarily fascinating, and he is definitely one of those cases, as you pointed out, of who has become largely forgotten now, really. Alas, because the book that he was producing and the images that he's producing are extraordinary. They are extraordinarily beautiful. He was kind of an underling. He was not a conventional, Louis-François Cassin was not a conventional artist, had not followed the conventional routes to, you know, fame and fortune. He was a provincial artist who became a drawing master, working with some wealthy families, some aristocratic families, giving him connections of all sorts, leading him to go to Rome. He was supported in this by various sponsors. And gradually he comes to know Choiseul Gouffier, who is constantly looking for new artists to add to his cadre, to his pool of working assistants. So Choiseul sends him out for about 2 years into the Ottoman Empire, a good bit of the Ottoman Empire. He travels through places that other people did not travel. He accomplishes this, comes back, spends time in Rome again as he's beginning to put this book together. And it's right around this time that he begins to seek greater independence. He begins to try to sort of sell some of his drawings. Choiseul hears about this and is very upset about it because he regards all of these things that Cassas has produced as his. He has paid the artist an allowance. Cassas keeps on pushing on things, and there's a lot of feuding between them. And it's around this time that the French Revolution breaks out. Through this, this great upheaval and sort of the shifting of property and notions of citizenship, Cassas is able to say, well, this is now my travel book, largely because Choiseul Gouffier becomes an emigre. He leaves Istanbul under a cloud and goes to Russia. So his property is taken from him and he loses the rights of citizenship. And Cassas is able to market the book as his book to the revolutionary committee, the Comité de Salut Public, and they accept it. They say, "Okay, we will support your book." But always in the background of this, the making of this extraordinary book is the sense of kind of competing with Choiseul and needing to somehow stand up against these great works that have been produced before him, particularly Choiseul's, and his own sense, Cassas's own sense of sort of marginality. So there is a sense in Cassas's work and publication that he's always kind of trying to outdo these other people and sort of stand independently, and that this leads to a kind of exaggeration of things. Many more images, for instance, than what Choiseul produced. He's working with at least twice, not three times, the numbers of engravers that Choiseul worked with, a far more ambitious project, projected to be three volumes from its very inception. The scale of his images, some of them are vast, three times the size of one page. Even the figures that he places in his sort of panoramic views of the Eastern Mediterranean are kind of outsized figures that appear to be monumental in a way that was not conventional for, the picturesque voyage genre. So in all these ways, I read him as kind of making a stake for his independence and trying to overcome his marginality within the world of publishing and, the art world.
Great. And yet he remains an underdog in a way, especially in comparison to the two nobles, Fulbin and Choiseul, who were able to rely on inherited wealth and family connections for the success of their endeavors. Perhaps not coincidentally, then, Cassas's story is one of failure. The monumental book project he undertook was never fully completed, and his aspired petite fortune and independency from his wealthy patron never acquired. And yet you decide to dedicate a significant amount of your book to Cassas, his travels and the book project. And you've already mentioned it's a shame he's been so neglected over time, because his drawings are so incredibly beautiful. But are there other reasons, or why do you think it is so important to remember his story of failure in particular?
Yeah, I mean, part of it is, of course, the way in which a kind of Orientalist narrative to some degree, which ties this kind of imagery to, notions of conquest and cultural the cultural inferiority of, you know, the Ottomans, and so a kind of triumphalist discourse of conquest and othering. All of that, I think, is countered by this great case of this wonderful book, which has some very deeply Orientalist commitments in various ways and places. But this book fails to be what it was supposed to be. And I think that's just a really interesting perspective in the, you know, kind of colonialist, Orientalist discourse that we have and that we've inherited, how it's been sort of devised over, you know, last, you know, 30, 40 years. So I think it's really interesting to point out that there is defeat or there is failure. There's a failure to be, as well as a kind of triumph or conquest. So I think I think that's one of the reasons that it's really fascinating thing. And of course, by no means do I mean to imply that Casas is a failed artist or that somehow, you know, his work is insignificant or not good in some technical artistic way at all. Quite the contrary. Some of the reasons why his project cannot come into existence are contingencies. They have to do with one, and first and foremost, probably Choiseul returning from exile and accepting Napoleon's amnesty. And he immediately engages in a lawsuit and tries to reclaim Casas's project as his property, and spends quite a number of years writing to various ministries using his connections and trying to get back the property. He doesn't seem to have ever succeeded. He seems simply to have succeeded in stalling the project. Money is running a little slim during the Napoleonic Empire because, you know, money being used for military purposes. And so the governmental support for the project, for Casas's project, is not as strong as it had been previously. And it just sort of sputters out for a lot of contingent reasons. And this notion of contingency was also something that I was very interested in, that there are so many parts to how these kinds of publications, these kinds of images are produced. And if we understand them in these contextual ways, it's a lot harder to see them as simple means or expressions of a kind of dominant perspective, a kind of colonialist conquest.
Right. This, again, ties in very nicely with chapter 3, The Translator's Art, in which concerns itself with the extraordinary Tableau Général de l'Empire Ottoman by Ottoman Armenian Murat Jol Dosun. I hope I pronounced this correctly. Please do correct me if I'm wrong. The three volumes were published between 1787 and 1820, so shortly after the Russian defeat of the Ottomans in 1774. By discussing the marvelous images and text of Dosun, you highlight the chosen likenesses between French and Ottoman imperial cultures as pictured in the book, beginning with the striking visual references Dosun makes to Choiseul's Voyage Pittoresque, and continuing with the adaptation of quote-unquote Persian manuscript paintings into engravings as well. And he stipulates that the goal was indeed to blur the boundaries between French and Ottoman forms. And you show this by discussing several of the so-called Persian manuscripts and then the French engravings side by side. There are, of course, striking differences between these two different genres, if you will. And to my mind, the engravings reveal striking differences which point to the fact that seeing is culturally determined. So when a French engraver looks at Persian album leaf, he or she might highlight certain aspects while eliminating others that would be important in the other contexts. So in a way, I'm kind of challenging your argument here. And I was wondering if you could comment.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Yeah, Muraja Dosin, you're absolutely right. He's, of course, he's what is called a dragoman. He's an interpreter working for the Ottomans. And dragomans are not just people who deal with language, but they are really dealing with kind of cultural connection. They are really diplomats in their own right. And I see that as really very much a part of what he's doing when he comes to Paris and, leaving the Ottoman Empire, coming to Paris to make this book, which is a really interesting choice. And some of it has to do with the fact that, you know, the French book trade is in a sort of glory moment. So he made that choice, pointedly. But I see him operating as a kind of emissary for the Ottomans. This is, as you said, a moment in which the Ottoman Empire is in a kind of fraught position, having recently lost to the Russians in the Russian-Ottoman war. And he's not operating in an official capacity, but we know he's probably sort of attempting to curry favor with the Sultan in acting as a kind of emissary who represents and defends Ottoman culture, which is my argument about his book. So I see him essentially trying to create a sort of a sense of overlap, a sense of, you know, that we can compare European culture and Ottoman culture, and we can sort of talk about similarities and differences, but that we can put them in the same essential frame. And so thereby feeling a relative sense of familiarity or comfort in sort of both worlds. So he wrote the text, right? And so I think the text really does attempt to do that, to create this sense of imbrication, of sort of overlap very strongly. And we can see that again as a kind of almost expression of his diplomatic role. For text, he has no capacity himself to make images, and he claims throughout that he has used images that were produced in the Ottoman Empire and has brought them to France. Those images are the basis for the engravings, the beautiful engravings in his book. And that's a really important prong to his claim to be producing something authentically Ottoman, right? That's the source of the images. We know some of those images, as you pointed out, some of them actually we can quite clearly see came from a very specific Ottoman manuscript. So we actually have paintings that we can look at and compare to the engravings, and that really is a very interesting exercise. What you say is interesting, that certainly one can see that the engravings themselves, which are all made by French engravers, they're certainly not Ottoman looking for all sorts of reasons. On the other hand, what's very interesting about them is they are not terribly French looking either. And that's what really piqued my interest and what got me involved in this book, is trying to understand where these images came from. My first glance at it, I had no knowledge of where he came from and why he made this. And I was just responding to the images. They really don't look like French engravings for the most part. There are a few exceptions. So one of the things that really interested me was just the varieties of images, some of them looking very French, some of them looking sort of like something sort of halfway French, and then some of them looking even less French. So the sense that in looking at the book that you're looking at degrees of translation, I think was very important to my reading. And I think it comes partly because Dosin himself talks constantly about that fact that the images come from the Ottoman Empire. So any reader knows that these are not, the engravings are made after Ottoman paintings. And so the reader would be aware of this process of translation. So I felt that it forces the reader, the book forces the reader into a kind of experience of cultural translation and kind of cultural encounter in thinking through these varieties of approaches. And then we have some really interesting writing by the person who was the engraver who was charged with overseeing all of the engravings, a well-known 18th century French engraver named Cochin. He wrote quite a bit about what he was doing and what he was seeing. And he writes very explicitly about the process. He complains about the quality of the Ottoman paintings. He regards them clearly as very different from French art and problematic because they are not perspectival. But he also says that they have a quality of truth and authenticity to them, and that the most difficult thing for him as an engraver is to try to retain that quality of truth, even as he makes engravings that he will find acceptable to present, you know, to the art world of the late 18th century. And this led me to think about what in translation theory is called markedness, the way in which some translations attempt to retain something of the texture of the original language, even as you know, they change words and other things into a foreign language. And I felt that Cochin and Cochin's engravings attempted to do this. And I call this a kind of performing Ottomanness, that he is, in order to do that, he has to look carefully at the Ottoman images that he worked from and study them in a way. So he himself is engaged in a kind of cultural encounter as he produces the engravings for this book, that he's, you know, really having to think about what makes this look Ottoman and what can I do when I make the engraving, when I make the reproduction of this image, to avoid kind of obliterating that quality. So he had to probably think very carefully about similarities and differences between Ottoman art. And I think one feels that in his engravings and some of the others. There are other engravings where clearly the maker said, you know, I don't care. You know, I want to make a beautiful French engraving, and I'm just going to completely ignore the sort of qualities that seem different and just completely overcome them. So it's a fascinating process, and it's a fascinating sort of sense of varieties of approaches, visual approaches to the art of translation, I think.
Now let's get to chapter 4, in which you discuss Melling's Istanbul in miniatures and black and white. Melling, a European artist, had worked for Selim and his sister for nearly 20 years, and he also built Selim's sister's palaces and garden. In the images of Melling's travel book, Voyage pittoresque de Constantinople, published in 1819, you argue that Melling identified in many ways with Ottoman culture. And I would like you to talk a bit more about this and how this contributes to the overall argument of your book.
Yes, he's a really, really interesting case because he spent such a long time in Istanbul and arrived there as a young artist and lived there for about 18 years. So I'm really trying to kind of deconstruct the idea that anytime a European is depicting the Ottomans, they're looking at the Ottomans sort of as an outsider or without knowledge or without deeper understanding or allegiance, in his case, actually to the Sultan and his family. One of the things that's very prominent in his book is the fact that it features waterways and very specifically the Bosphorus, which is so different from the kinds of images that you tend to see in other travel books. And that was so notable that I had to kind of really think that through. And I was really helped by the research of Shirin Hamada, who has worked a lot on 18th century country, Istanbul, and a kind of development of a new form of urbanization with the spread of suburban houses, residences, palaces, really, along the Bosphorus. And the Sultan himself participates in this, in the construction of suburban Istanbul, again, along the water. And it's part of his larger desire to be very visible to the people, to his people, to anyone, and to really promote his presence in the world, rather than do what he had done in the past, what sultans had done in the past, which was sort of to hide away in Topkapi Palace and be very reclusive, be very sort of hidden. So the fact that Meleng features the waterways and these palaces built by the sultan, they're called yalas, a certain palatial type, so prominently was really one major clue. But he also picks up on new visual genres that were developing as he was in Istanbul that sort of begin in the imperial palace, and that is a kind of mural painting which builds from painting traditions, book painting traditions in the Ottoman Empire, but now is on view in within palaces themselves. And they actually depict these yalas, these palaces, these waterfront palaces, and Bosphorus views. And his prints look very much like those mural paintings. So it was very clear that he was dealing with a kind of Ottoman visual culture, both in his understanding of sort of sultanic ideology, but also in terms of the kind of visual cues in his work. And it's very different from other artists who don't register those things at all, even when they're depicting those palaces or the Bosphorus. They just depict them in a very, very different way. So he was important for me because he really is a very cross-cultural figure, very profoundly so. You know, he returns to Europe when he's in his early 40s. So he's now a middle-aged person who has spent, you know, all of his years kind of learning to be an artist within the Ottoman court. And so I argue that he's actually an Ottoman court artist, really. And so that we should sort of challenge this notion of him as, you know, since he was born in Europe, that he's remained simply a European artist when he makes his travel book, which he makes in Paris. So it was very important to me to really look at this particular case because I think it kind of complicates the way we talk about Ottoman-European relations to look at a figure like this.
Definitely, yeah. And it ties in very nicely with the third part of the book as well. But I do want to follow up on the comparison between the mural paintings and the illustrations for a published book, ultimately, or an album, because I think it's interesting. And I was wondering whether you could say just a few more words on how the iconography was, you know, maybe adapted or similar in many ways, because mural paintings would have been architecturally, you know, indoors and seen in a very different way to an album or a book.
Yeah, there are many very striking aspects of them. I mean, one is just the themes, the subject matter. They tend to, mural paintings tend to depict, again, Bosphorus views. I mean, that's almost exclusively what they depict, even as the type of mural painting spreads out way beyond Istanbul into other places within the Ottoman Empire. They continue to depict the Bosphorus, which is very striking. And these yalas, this very specific palatial type, which is a waterfront palace. So the subject matter is very similar to Meleng's subject matter in his prints. And then the way of depicting things with this very linear emphasis, very hard kind of outlines, a great kind of emphasis on kind of clarity, a kind of horizontal structure, which is very similar to the horizontal thrust or format of Meleng's prints. The same kind of angles of vision, sort of generally, not always, but sort of a low-lying angle, you know, from which one sees these palaces along the Bosphorus is shared, again, both by the mural paintings and Meleng. And then this kind of focus on detail, a detail without any kind of discrimination of sort of center and periphery, visually both forms sort of treat everything with kind of equal emphasis. All of these things make them very strikingly alike. You know, one of the things that's fascinating about mural paintings is that they depict a view that you could have by looking through these great walls of window, which is typical of the kind of palace architecture, the yala. And so they depict what you actually would see looking out of these windows. But also they could depict what you would see from outside of the yala, looking at a yala, because of course you can see from both sides. And this kind of notion of transparency, I think, is something that Melling picks up in the way that those prints are structured. There's sort of an emphasis on everything being kind of out in the open and great clarity. There are no shadows, there are no trees. So I think that he's actually working on a kind of aesthetics of transparency, which is both the aesthetic of the mural painting and its function within the yala and how a yala works as a form of architecture, but also what the Sultan wants. He wants this kind of visibility and transparency. So it's sort of operates on several levels.
Fascinating. Detail is definitely also something that Louis Dupré in the next chapter that you're going to discuss in the next chapter, in chapter five, is prone towards, if you will. And so we're moving on to part three of the book called Contradictory Contact. And he really demonstrate further that travelers were not trapped within preconceived discourses, but rather interacted with other peoples in similar ways as you've already done in the case of Melling. And in chapter five, as I say, you go on to discuss Louis Dupré's costume albums, which were made for the Voyage à Athènes et à Constantinople, which was published in Paris in 1825, so slightly later than Melling. It is from this body of works that you also choose the cover image of your book, called The Palace and the Fortress of Ionia, seen from the lake, a Turk and a young Greek. And these representations of costume convey cultural identity in a similar way, maybe as monuments and panoramas do in the case of Melling, for example. And so I would like you to talk a bit more about dress as topographical body, and maybe also tell our listeners why you chose this one particular image by Dupré as a front cover.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Dupré's images are really fascinating, and they do feature costume, which is very interesting. It's a travel book. It's really not a costume book, but the costume is so foregrounded that that was something that I thought I really needed to account for somehow. You know, there is this genre of costume album that was produced both in Europe and in the Ottoman Empire by Ottoman artists that are, you know, costume images, just simply single figures, usually on a page, you know, depicting the costume of a given type within the Ottoman Empire. And I think he really plays off of that because his images, again, foreground costume, but they're usually scenic, they're settings. They have kind of, most of them, not all of them, have whole context. They have people interacting. So that's very striking about his work. That particular image was striking for the, you know, the cover of the book because it does depict a Greek and a Turk, so-called. I mean, this is the language of kind of European usage. The person who's called a Turk would more likely just simply be called an Ottoman because he's of the Ottoman elite. But this kind of very close interaction, they're sitting in a boat together, kind of very, you know, very close to each other. It's very ambiguous. We don't know what's happening. We don't know, you know, who they are exactly. The travel account, the actual writing of Dupré's book doesn't explain any more about their identity. So we just have this title, Turk and Greek. And they're in front of a famous palace that belonged to Ali Pasha, who was the Ottoman-appointed Albanian ruler in Janina, in sort of northwest Greece today. So it kind of alludes to some sort of larger power construct. But what's really fascinating about this image and what makes his images in general stand out is not just that he departs from this kind of very strict costume types, but the way in which it is filled with all these signs of what we might call temporality and contact, the fact that we're looking at a very, very particular moment. And it gives his images a kind of ambiguity and a charge and this feeling of interaction, the feeling of his presence, you know, that he's hovering in front of these views, looking at these people, interacting with these people, that really just completely, to my mind, departs from the genre, both of costume images and travel images. So, you know, his text for this book in many ways is very practically stereotypical. It's what we call a Philhellenic text. It is written during the Greek War of Independence against the Ottomans, which Western Europeans very much identified with and very much supported the Greeks. So it's filled with this kind of invective against the Ottomans and, you know, kind of a pro-Greek mentality. But when we look at his images, we feel something very different from this very kind of stock kind of view that the text conveys. The text conveys just, you know, very, again, very typical sort of ideas of that moment towards the Ottomans and not very friendly ones. But that kind of distance perspective that the text conveys is just not there in the images because of this real, really strong sense of again, presence and interaction. They're very individualized. In that particular print, we see, you know, a bird flying overhead. There's an oar that's dripping water. There's a kind of this look of sunlight kind of dappled, you know, and reflecting across the faces of these figures. They're both sort of looking outwards as though their attention is caught by something. So all these really curious and ambiguous elements that suggest, again, a kind of lively interaction and, you know, the fact that Dupré himself knew these people. So different from that kind of stereotyped view that his text and also other kinds of costume images tend to depict.
And also in the last chapter, in chapter 6, things are not what they seem to be. Here you discuss Delacroix's sketches from his travels to North Africa in 1932. These works are really beautifully intricate and intimate, and they really problematize, if you will, the body of works of work that Delacroix is generally known for. As such, the sketchbooks are particularly important in your words because they do not confirm an unremittent sameness or seamless continuity with all imperialist imagery. And rather, you situate them, the sketchbooks, within a context of ambiguities and insecurities, even of a European traveler in a place where he had little control. And again, I would like you to elaborate on these points and what you mean by that, maybe even by discussing one of the sketchbooks. I'm going to be honest with you. I had difficulty seeing the insecurities within these really intricate works of Delacroix.
Yeah. That's fine. yeah, they were a complete surprise to me when I first encountered those sketchbooks, because I would say fundamentally in their making, they are so different from what Delacroix did when he did, you know, basically they're watercolors and drawings. So it's a sketching technique. So it's a drawing based medium, really. Typical of kind of travel imagery made in situ, right? And, you know, if one is familiar with his practices as a draftsman, that's when you begin to see these differences. And that's kind of what I was building from, just this really strong sense of difference, you know, that he's really stepped away from what he normally does. And that was became very important to me because, yes, there's a kind of language around his journey to North Africa, or indeed any artist's encounter of the so-called Orient, or you know, the East, or what have you, has always been kind of, has long been dealt with as this kind of, again, unremitting sameness, sort of, you know, they were informed by certain cultural prejudices, these artists traveling, they confirm these cultural prejudices, they return with their cultural prejudices intact and continue to make images as they did before their journeys. And looking at these sketchbooks, I thought, no, there's something else going on here. And we really need to account for the very specific things that happen when people travel. And that, you know, there are lots of other experiences that kind of impinge on what the artist is, that the artist is not some kind of essence that's, you know, just transported around and always staying the same, but is, you know, modified by experiences. And so I began thinking about that whole notion of cultural contact. This was really the genesis of the whole project, because I was really thinking about how we could formulate travel and contact in a way that would, you know, be a little more nuanced, right? So that was kind of my point of departure. And you know, I began building from very specific things that I saw. I can, you know, talk about a few of them here. I mean, one of them is the sense of distance that we have in his work. From everything he sees, very different from Dupre, where we feel that contact constantly. But that sense of not having access to things, that is, I think, part of the feeling of constraint around those images. He was traveling under very specific circumstances. They were not traveling to a place when they were in Morocco where the French had any control whatsoever. They were traveling to a sovereign empire with a sultan. They traveled with armed guards, with escorts. They were made to stay in camps away from any town and any city, so they did not have direct contact. And even once they get to the imperial city of Meknes, they are, again, their movements are very controlled and very specific. They're told when they can go places, where they can go, who they can go with, things like this, Delacroix and this diplomatic mission that he accompanied. So again, that sense of constraint, I think, is partly visible in the distance from which we see everything. And that's even where he gets direct access. I mean, we could take the example of one of the very lovely drawings that I discussed, the Jewish bride, where he actually is in a home. The Jewish interpreter who accompanied him sort of gave him access to families and, you know, Jewish families, which is where he had the closest contact with people. And there's something very specific about the way that he renders this young woman with a kind of constraint, I might say desexualization or de-eroticization, that is completely, different from the kinds of images of what we might call others or othering that we would typically experience in Delacroix's imagery of women. There's a sense of kind of remove, a kind of stiffness, even in the drawing, which is very different from his sort of gestural practice of drawing. Just a sense of kind of discomfort and lack of access. So those are a couple things. I think one of the most important things for me was his constant depiction, particularly when he gets to the imperial city, of thresholds. But they're sort of throughout the notebooks, these sort of doorways and windows and walls and gates. So we see constantly ways in which French presence is mediated, this constant representation of being outside something, trying to look into something, but of course not being inside of those things, which I think is really a theme, you know, thematizes the traveler, the situation of a traveler. You know, traveler isn't inside, but sort of outside looking in, but also lack of access, lack of control. And I think it's really important because in travel imagery, you know, if one looks comparatively, it's very frequently the case that the traveler makes no reference to himself. That, you know, the travel images operate as though one has access to this culture, and kind of erases the self from those images in order to kind of capture this sort of, you know, sort of purely exoticized vision of this other world, you know, without any contact with the European presence. But he's not doing that. And that struck me as really very, very particular, that he's constantly alluding to himself by virtue of these thresholds, these, you know, liminal spaces that he is, you know, hovering outside of. And they have an even almost illicit quality, sort of like views that one should not have or would like to have but cannot have, that I think is so self-referential and so fraught that they really stand for that, that kind of, again, that sort of powerlessness, I would say, that he felt. I mean, really, one has to look at these images within a kind of large history of both Delacroix's own imagery and how he departs, both in very specific technical ways and thematic ways, but also travel images and what they typically do and do not do. And within that context, I think they're very specific and really, really very precious.
And in the postscript, you also add, make another point, which is this, that all these works discussed really were so particular and could have not really worked at any other time period. So that, you know, later periods, later into the 19th century, when the British Empire really kind of expanded and became even more powerful, these works would have maybe not been created in the same way. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely one of the things that I really wanted to accomplish with this book, is to look at very particular circumstances and understand all the things that are at stake, both in a sort of an individual traveler's presence and knowledge and commitments, but also, you know, the relations of, you know, a French traveler, a British traveler, because of, you know, sort of world issues, historical issues, political issues, that all of those things play a role in what happens. And I do think, I mean, it's generally thought that sort of as the 19th century progresses, of course, and as kind of Western European colonialism really develops as a kind of ideology, that things become more fraught and hardened. And, you know, there is kind of a full-blown sort of, you know, Orientalism. So on the one hand, I think all images are very specific. On the other hand, there's also this larger discourse about kind of growing Orientalism and growing colonialism. And I'm sort of looking at this moment where I think, you know, there's still a lot of kind of bilateral looking, you know, multi-directional interactions that I think are very important. On the other hand, I would also say that even when within the most sort of rabid Orientalist discourse, one can probably always find some elements of contact and exchange happening kind of underneath that.
These are wonderful last words, I think, to this interview. Maybe to wrap this up, you can tell our listeners what it is that you're working on now that you've finished this magnum opus, really.
Yes. Well, I became so excited about these costume albums, in part, well, through many of the travelers' projects that I was looking at. And then I realized it was very particular. So the fact that as Europeans are creating these costume books, beginning really in the 16th century, that the Ottomans also are producing costume albums, both depicting the Ottoman Empire, and that there is some kind of cross-cultural interaction in this genre. So that the genre itself really probably should be called, you know, kind of transcultural form itself. And that became so engaging to me that I really wanted to pursue that. So yeah, that's my next project, is kind of about that interaction and how to understand it. Also trying to understand it not as a kind of in a sort of exclusively Eurocentric way, which is, you know, alas, too often the case, both with travel books, but also costume albums and books, but to really understand sort of what the Ottomans bring to this and how Europeans are often trying themselves to kind of produce travel costume imagery that looks Ottoman itself. So yes, it extends very much out from the project of Mediterranean encounters.
Fascinating. I'm very much looking forward to reading your next book. And for now, I thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me about your book, Mediterranean Encounters, Artists Between Europe and the Ottoman Empire, between 1774 and 1839. Thank you, Elizabeth.
Thank you, Ricarda. It was really great.